we put in those equity filters of race, culture, gender, age, economic status, if we use those filters in conjunction with universal design, we have a much more inclusive application that deals not only with the physical phenomena, but the social phenomena.
At Home with Growing Older is a nonprofit organization which believes in peer learning and creating discussions which bring the lens of aging to a variety of topics. At Home with Growing Older is proud to be your host of At Home on Air, a radio hour offering connection, community, and knowledge to our participants remotely. Now, we invite you to listen and learn from this live recorded episode of At Home on Air.
Welcome to At Home on Air. I am Susie Stadler. I am an architect by profession and also the executive director of At Home with Growing Older and the producer of this podcast. In our interviews, we explore the meaning of being at home with growing older from two angles. One is how we can adapt our living environments to better support us and empower us as we age. And then how we can cultivate a sense of belonging within our communities and ourselves. These explorations are made possible through the insights of inspiring guests from the arts, medicine, social services, design and beyond, and through the questions and comments from you, our listeners. So thank you for being here. Our topic is designing across the lifespan. 30 years of teaching and enhancing inclusive design values and benefits. Our guest is Professor Ricardo Gomez. He is a lifelong educator and advocate for universal and inclusive design. After 33 years of teaching at the School of Design at SF State University, Professor Gomez is retiring, sort of, because his lifelong commitment to teaching and advancing inclusive design will continue to have a lasting impact as he shifts his focus to research life-centered design. Welcome to At Home on Air, Professor Gomez.
Well, thank you, Susie, and all of your podcast guests. It's quite a pleasure to be here, and I feel this podcast is somewhat launching my renaissance in terms of the direction of my design future.
We'll watch for that, Ricardo. I hope we can have this impact. In today's episode, we are going to explore the importance of inclusive design, how to put it into practice, and why it's more crucial than ever. Let's dive right in. Professor Gomez's journey into design began in the early 80s, not because he was drawn to creating beautiful objects, but because he was asking a bigger question: how can design improve the human experience? And that mindset has shaped his entire career. To kick things off, Professor Gomez, could you define for us the terms universal design, inclusive design, and life-centered design?
Sure. It's my pleasure to elaborate on what is inclusive design, universal design, and life-centered design. As you stated, it began in the early 80s with myself in terms of my graduate work and undergraduate work. I did my undergraduate work at Massachusetts College of Art in Boston. I'm from Boston, even though I'm here in San Francisco and have been here for the 33 years that you cited. In the 80s, I was finishing up my undergraduate work. And at that time, I had the wonderful opportunity to be associated with what was then Adaptive Environments in Boston, which is now called the Institute of Human-Centered Design. It happened to be housed in my studio at Massachusetts College of Art. I embarked on developing a project which looked at creating an adaptive structural environment for severely disabled and developmentally challenged children. At the time, universal design was not established formally until 1991, following the passing of the ADA in 1990, led by Ron Mace at the Center for Universal Design at North Carolina State University. Many of the people I was associated with through adaptive environments and later on to the expanded community of universal design experts and advocates, we started dealing with how design can be more equitable, particularly for persons who may have felt that they were not addressed in what was perhaps a more commercial aspect of design. My interest in design and studying it was to make designing a difference, particularly as being one of African-American ancestry and also being very much a minority, being the first person to graduate with a degree in industrial design of African-American descent at Massachusetts College of Art. I didn't realize at the time that I was a pioneer. It was actually very humbling because it really told me that there was much to be done. So being introduced to universal design really meant engaging the users, being more inclusive. Even before the term inclusive design was coined, when I studied design over 40 years ago, design was meant to be exclusive. Designers were thought to be somewhat geniuses, that you don't have to interact with people to design something, you just have to be creative. And I always had a challenge with that because I felt design needed to be collaborative, needed to be cooperative, needed to be engaging.
And I think, to be honest, that continues today. Design has this stamp, and it's very difficult when you talk about design not to have this connotation of being exclusive or special, to be really in the service of everyday people.
Yeah, design needed to be engaging. And that's how I approached design before I knew about the seven principles of universal design, which largely deal with aspects of usability, the physical phenomena, equitable use, flexibility in use, simple and intuitive use. The word use always comes up in the universal design principles, all the way down to the seventh principle of size and space for approach and use. So the usability, the accessibility, the mobility, both cognitive and physical, were the factor. And as I started to embrace those principles and those methodologies, I realized there was still an absence that went beyond the physical phenomena, but really started to address more the social phenomena and how design impacts society. The social impact of design became prevalent in my ambition as a design student and eventually as a designer to try to address issues in design where I did not see it making an impact. Some of those principles actually came to my attention by looking at Maslow's pyramid of needs. When you look at the bottom of the pyramid, in terms of the physiological factors, up to the top of the pyramid, which was sort of the self-actualization. Looking at that pyramid of design, the bottom of the pyramid really was addressing the basic needs in our society, such as food, water, shelter. And design doesn't really address that intuitively. It was dealing more with being driven by the market society, by profit margin, by industry. I studied industrial design, but my ambition wasn't really to design for industry. It was to design for people, particularly those people who are most vulnerable. I wanted to find out how design could be used as a tool for development. Hence, universal design helped me to try to deal with a larger range of users, a wider range of users, without any stigma or any type of inferiority. But then after looking at the usability, I said, there's something about the absence of race, the identity factor, race, culture, gender, aging, the economy of scale. And that's where inclusive design started to be a factor. Having worked with what was then Adaptive Environments and later became the Institute for Human-Centered Design, there were a number of conferences internationally being sponsored around the 21st century of universal design and other aspects of our society, meaning the Southern Hemisphere, started saying, How does universal design relate to agrarian economies or economies that may be low income or may not be urban contemporary? And so we started saying, how can we make universal design more inclusive? Let's put in the race factor in terms of the fact that even though we may have universal design and usability, we understand that access, usability, is not equitable for everyone. We also think about age, and we can talk not only about the elderly, but also about the young. So we started thinking more about what we call the life cycle or the lifespan, saying, let's put in the factor of age. Let's put in the factor of gender, because we realize there was discrimination by design. There were people like Leslie Keynes Weissman, who wrote the book on design by discrimination, that talked about the feminist perspective on design. So we realized it was an inequity even within gender and even how we identify with gender, which is certainly still a hot button topic today. Then we looked at economy of scale. Usability is fine to try to make it more inclusive from a usability perspective, but not everybody has the same access, be it from an educational level, from a housing level, from a level of health and wellness. We realized through COVID that we had a tremendous health inequity, which was always there, but COVID really demonstrated where that line was and where those who are on the front line and most vulnerable to COVID and other dilemmas that were inequities within our health and wellness. When we put in those equity filters of race, culture, gender, age, economic status, if we use those filters in conjunction with universal design, we have a much more inclusive application that deals not only with the physical phenomena, but the social phenomena. As we know today in society, there's controversial issues about whether or not the social phenomena is relevant. We had challenges to affirmative action when I was going through school, where it does no longer exist the way it did before. And now we look at challenges to design equity inclusion. That's a bad word. People are withdrawing for that because they've targeted that. They've created a fear around equity and inclusion. As many of us know who advocate those types of inclusive principles, it's really about us celebrating all we can offer in terms of education, value systems, and the way which we can celebrate life. So how do we make design more inclusive? And by that, making design a tool, making it a principle, making it an ethic.
And what about life-centered design? How does this fit into universal and inclusive design?
The notion of life-centered design really acknowledges that design does not begin and end in one place. It's a cycle. Like life, it's a cycle. And we talk about the lifespan of design. And we talk about how designing can be utilized to design a difference, to make an impact on what we do. In this term, life-centered design, I have many people who I look at for inspiration, the works of the Massive Change Network in terms of Bruce Mao and B.C. Williams, or I look at what's being done in the Institute for Human-Centered Design, led by Valerie Fletcher, how they look at consulting and advising in a very inclusive manner, or even look at other ecologists. Thinking more about, can design be more user-centered, more people-centered? We started thinking about a synthesis of people, place, meaning the environment, the setting, the location, and the process, meaning the type of technology or technique or strategy that you will use to facilitate what is the dynamic of the people or the user and the place and environment. The syntax of people, place, and process. It wasn't just about process, wasn't just about the design, wasn't just about the object. Think about a Venn diagram. You have those three overlapping circles and that little sweet spot in the middle. That's design. It's incorporating the user, incorporating the environment, and incorporating the process, meaning the appropriate process, be it if you want to talk about from a material perspective, from a ecological perspective, from a sustainable perspective, even from a cost-effective perspective. So there's a lot of factors that constitute what is the process, how you deliver it, how you implement it. But it has to be in sync with the environmental conditions or situation, in addition to the user. That kind of a thinking process, that holistic thinking process, is not something that I was taught as a designer, but intuitively, this is what I always felt was the formula, what was essential to really creating design that was not only effective, tangible, viable, but also sustainable and also experiential. Design really is more about assessing the user experience. Many people get disillusioned by being enamored by the object, be it a website, be it an application, be it about UI, UX. These are all methods to the solution. What is most important is what is the outcome? What is the experience that is resolved?
Yes, assessing the user experience and studying it is really at the core of or the beginning of the design process.
Also, I tell my students, be careful that you are not just designing this object, this image, this gadget or widget, but you're really trying to design the optimal experience for the user.
The user experience has changed over time. Our opportunities to connect user experience, how does this factor into your studio?
I had an opportunity to study architecture at UCLA. Then I was studying design for low-income economies, how design can be used as a tool for development, which meant I had to work with the people, because when I designed a container system for mobile healthcare delivery in East Africa, I had to reassess what's the role of an industrial designer in a non-industrial society. You basically have to rethink yourself. You have to retool yourself. Going back to, again, when I was at Mass College of Art and my project was adaptive structural environment, it was really creating a learning environment. So it was about education, but it was about the fact that I knew I was an art or design student. And I knew nothing about formal education, curricular design, curricular innovation. And I knew nothing about working with children with severe physical disabilities or cognitive development disabilities. So I had to observe. My first intuition was to go there. It was almost like one says, build this field of dreams, but it's not just build it and they will come. That's a little bit presumptuous, maybe even very arrogant, to assume that I will make something and people will be attracted to it without having to even go there and observe what they really need or what they really want or what they need to advance themselves or secure themselves or sustain themselves. I mentioned earlier about Maslow's pyramids. How do we raise that bottom of the pyramid to the point where self-actualization can be attained even at the bottom of the pyramid? How do we sustain that? That was one, learning environments. From there, I went to Kenya to primary healthcare delivery. I knew nothing about primary healthcare delivery. I knew you have to have that beginner's mindset. You have to understand that you have a certain knowledge or skill set, but how do you adapt that knowledge and skill set? How do you evolve that knowledge and skill set? So I realized that I had to take classes in public health. So I took courses in the School of Public Health at UCLA. I took courses in third world development, in urban planning. I took courses in Africana studies to understand the African environment, because I knew I had to understand the people, I had to understand the place, and I had to understand when I would find or resolve the ultimate process. And that took me not only to Kenya, but that took me to Paris, to the Les Ateliers, the School of Design, where I was the coordinator of design projects in developing countries. And I used to place students all over Europe with various development agencies, working with government and agencies in Ethiopia, Kenya, Madagascar, Zimbabwe. This was, again, trying to find inroads in design. And this was brought to my acuity through working with my mentor, Dr. Nathan Shapira at UCLA. In fact, where I'm speaking with you right now is in the Shapira Design Archive at San Francisco State University, because I left Boston in 1980 to study at UCLA because it was the only school in the country at that time that had a focus on design for developing countries, design for low-income economies. Everything that I have shared with you isn't because of my own ability. It was the people that I engage with. It was about co-designing, collaborating, community, collective. It's the CO factor that really elevates design.
All this experience factors into the process design, and the beginner's mind is a really important point of departure too. And I just want to bring up this example in one of your design studios, which was, how do you buy 5 tomatoes? So not too long ago, you went to a grocery store and you had a group of students sort of shadow an older adult, Dr. June Fisher, in doing this. Nowadays, the process of buying 5 tomatoes might be very different. You can order it online. How did this impact inclusive design?
Dr. June Fisher was a physician. She's 91 years old today. The Goldman Institute on Aging in San Francisco, they were highlighting this woman who had these 2 walking sticks, who was going around influencing Fortune 500 about making design inclusive, making design accessible, and the age factor. Back then, we were calling it aging in place. Then we realized aging is not unique to elderly people. We all age continually. And if we address issues of longevity at the beginning of life, there's a good chance we will have some robust longevity and become octogenarians or even be as fortunate as Dr. Fisher to be 91. And I had the opportunity 12 years ago to meet Dr. June Fisher at the first launching of the Stanford Center on Longevity Design Challenge. And I had my graduate students from San Francisco State competing, and they ended up being finalists in that project. We're still doing it today, 12 years later. We're working with students in China, in Beijing, and they've become finalists in the Stanford Design Challenge. In fact, in the 12 years we've been participating at Stanford and working with Dr. June Fisher, we have had over 10 finalists. Now, the 5 tomatoes was from myself going to a farmer's market with Dr. June Fisher, and we went shopping. And I went shopping from her perspective, how she shops. She wanted to buy 5 tomatoes. But if she buys those 5 tomatoes, where is she going to put it? Because she used these walking sticks, she could kind of try to hold the 5 tomatoes, then move her sticks, and then the tomatoes are flapping around in a plastic bag. So this became sort of the problem scenarios that we would look at. And I introduced it to my students. From that point on, we developed a community partnership in which she would come in every semester and work with me, not at the end of what the students were doing, but at the beginning of what students were doing. We became this co-designing entity. She was there when they were developing mock-ups and prototypes and testing and this iterative process. I told my students, Dr. Fisher has the golden touch. Everybody she works with, their projects turn to gold because she has this phenomenal ability of not only having been at Stanford, but teaching design at Stanford, teaching design at UC Berkeley, teaching design at California College of Arts, and teaching design at San Francisco State University. When I say teaching, I mean collaborating. She brought expertise and experience I did not have or could not share with the students. Empathy was key. Having that understanding of the problem, being able to, one, identify the problem, being able to then understand the problem, then being able to define the problem before you design the problem. And unfortunately, when I was taught design, you just basically did a few ideas and the teacher would tell you, give me 60 concept sketches and 4 prototypes next time we meet. And we never talked with anybody. We just talked to ourselves. There were extreme limitations and inequities about you being the sole reference to creativity or to the future of how design impacts society. So it became essential that one had to collaborate with people like Dr. June Fisher. She also was one of the people that coined the phrase with me, design with us, not for us. And that is the mantra that I advocate to all the students and everyone that I work with. When I teach students in my graduate degree projects or graduate seminars, they are required to work with a partner. They are required to establish a community partner, establish comparative analysis, to establish an inherent understanding of the subject matter. My mentor, Nathan Shapiro, I called him the design ambassador because what made him most important was he did not just share design with designers. The key is to get people who are non-designers to become designers. And by designers, meaning being able to understand design thinking or design methodology or principle.
Yes. Ricardo, thank you for giving me this jumping board because making people who are non-designers, designers, that's exactly what we do in our Aging 360 workshops, where we basically teach people who have never gone through a design process to start with assessing a problem, naming a problem, and then starting experimenting with solutions. What you said before, that people were just presented with the ideas of designers who had never even talked to them. We as users and consumers also have been sort of beaten into submission over the years. We just sort of accept often what's presented to us, and we don't even dare to have expectations that something is really designed for us.
You are listening to At Home On Air. We are now switching to questions by participating audience members in this recorded live episode. If you want a chance to ask your question, visit us at athomewithgrowingolder.org and register for the next live episode.
Jim's question, how do you get seniors who are resistant because they don't want to be seen as seniors?
Dr. Fisher, she always tells me, I'm really an 18-year-old trapped in the body of a 91-year-old person. She joins me often on my graduate seminars, which are on Wednesday evenings between 6 and 9, and we have many outside people to join us. I tell Dr. Fisher, I hope that if I ever get to be 91, I'm able to be attending a Zoom session, listening and critiquing and providing inspiration to the next or incoming thought leaders of tomorrow. At San Francisco State, we had an organization called the 60 Plus Club. They were former alumni or faculty or staff. It was basically a senior organization on campus. And we would reach out to them to come into our classroom and work with the students. And again, not just to come in at the final stage to give feedback that's probably a little bit late in time, but feedback that's timely, meaning while the ideas are still fresh, while the ideas are still formulating. And so we had students working with the 60 Plus Club. We had students working with OnLock, which is part of the Institute on Aging here in San Francisco. We used to always go to various assisted living facilities and engage, and the students would work with them. We would form little groups and teams, and they would come back and consult with them. Someone who is elderly has tremendous knowledge and resource. Someone who is young and ambitious and is really harnessing all the new technology but doesn't really know how to use it in the most efficient way, if they find the sources that they can work with, this is where they're going to begin to find great success and relevance in what they do.
You incentivize and encourage students to go to the older person.
Yes. And you know, I've had students approach you with At Home With Growing Older. The most dynamic projects and the most successful projects have been those who have worked with partners. It just behooves me how a student can say, I'm going to design for the elderly, or I'm going to design for children, or I'm going to design for somebody who is visually impaired, but they don't work with them. They just observe them, study them, but they don't engage with them.
That's a big difference. I want to segue to Professor Claire Cooper-Marcus's question. Do you teach your students to evaluate built examples in terms of how well they serve users as a way of learning about people-centered design?
Most definitely. For example, when we do a research project, there are three pillars that we address. One, initially, it was called Hear, Create, Deliver. Hear was like developing empathy, understanding, being able to hear, to listen, observe. Create, obviously, to design, to sketch, to model, to prototype, to test. But the most critical factor of any prototyping or testing or creating is getting feedback and getting measures. What are the metrics? What are the measures? How does it work? Why does it work? Have you consulted one with that? And then the final stage is to implement it. To implement it means to deliver it. And deliver it means to get feedback and measures. So these are things that are extremely important. We can call hear inspiration. We can call create ideation. We can call deliver implementation. And there are many ways in which we have these various intervals. And again, design is a cycle. It's not linear. Because you go past a certain stage doesn't mean you just keep going. You may have to go back and revise it and to change it. Change is important. Change and discovery is what is key. Before we even design, when an idea comes forward or the thought of an idea, first and foremost, to find out who else has done it. You do what we call a comparative analysis. It's just like if you were a designer, you're working with a client, you have to find out who else has designed it. You do patent searches, you do trademarks, copyrights, you find out what's out there. Because from a student perspective, students aren't the experts. They don't have the knowledge base. If they're going to try and embark on a design process, in the best scenario, it may be a semester. That's only 3 or 4 months, 16 weeks. There are many people who are in business for many, many years and developing projects over 5-year plans. So going to consult with those sources is the first thing that one begins to do. Once they start establishing that secondary research in terms of finding out what's out there, then they start trying to establish direct connections with consultants or mentors or community partners who they can then interview and observe and work off their database or their knowledge base. This is the type of active engagement that we encourage students to do.
Yeah, thank you. And I think this kind of active engagement and evaluating existing products is, in a way, what all of us can do in our daily life, and we don't do it enough. I want to segue to Yasmin Khan's question. Can you share an example of a Stanford Design Challenge winning entry?
Oh, sure. Let's go back to Dr. June Fisher. We're going to go all the way back to the five tomatoes that Susie spoke of earlier. In 2016, I had two students, Brandon Lopez and Eric Rainier. They developed a project called City Cart, and they built a shopping cart around Dr. Fisher's coming and going to the market. Part of the observation was we were trying to address the shopping experience. Now, the shopping experience is not only relevant to when you are shopping, whether that's in a supermarket, choose to go to Whole Foods, or going to a farmer's market. It's also getting there. How do you get from your house or where you live to the place in which you want to shop? So now that takes into other issues of transportation. Are you taking a bus or a train, or are you driving? Or are you doing an Uber? The other factor with Dr. Fisher, where she lived, she had 16 steps outside her house and then 16 more steps inside her house. She had to go up 30 stairs every day with the walking sticks. And I used to pick her up and take her home, and she refused any assistance. I would just watch her take one step at a time. And she took a lot of pride in being able to make that kind of ascent and descent. So understanding the whole holistic experience, I talked earlier about people, place, process. Another scenario I have the students do is do what we call a day in the life scenario, where they have to track somebody from the morning to the evening, from when they're in their home, how they get from their home to their destination, be it shopping or be it school or be it work or going to the playground or the park. And we then document, because if you only focus on the supermarket or the farmer's market, but you don't focus on the transportation or the accessibility, the mobility, then you're missing a key factor. It may not have anything to do with the actual shopping location. It's the process of getting there.
I'm just curious, Ricardo, what was the innovative aspect about the city card? How did it take into consideration what you just said?
I have a card in front of me. It's called the New Shopping Experience. We are not improving on what already exists. We are making something new. Shopping promotes happiness and well-being. City card serves the needs of the aging community beyond walking assistance, because they're able to use it as a walker, but also they can put their food in it, they can put their coffee in it, they can collapse it so it can go in the back of a trunk of a car if they were to take an Uber or any other kind of assist. Now, the big challenge for someone like Dr. Fisher, dynamics we have to address, is that when you go shopping, you're not carrying anything, so you don't have a load. But once you shop, now you have all this weight you're carrying. How are you going to get that up those stairs? Now, it didn't go up the stairs, but it had big wheels so that you could easily pull it up the stairs. You have to deal with a different range of mobility issues. Would you need assistance? Yes, there are some going to have to get some assistance. In life, we need assistance in one time or the other. I've had challenges that have really helped me better understand health and wellness. If I was able to show you this card that I have in front of me, it shows Dr. Fisher in front of her 16 stairs outside her home with the shopping cart and her coffee in it. And then it shows her also going through the supermarket, because she didn't have to use one of the carts over in Whole Foods. She could use her own cart. So the city cart, by the way, won first place in the Stanford Design Challenge. This is an international design competition. I encourage you to look online under Stanford Design Challenge, and you'll see the projects that have been done over the last 12 years. Another project that Dr. Fisher helped us with was called Garden Cart. Another student, a Japanese student that I was working with, worked with Dr. Fisher and designed it around her doing gardening in the front of her home and even in the back of her home. That project was not only a finalist, but was a winner. So we had all these carts that you could use to stabilize yourself and conduct your activities, whether it was gardening or whether it was shopping. So how do we integrate daily activities that help you to go outside the home and also engage in other daily activities that help sustain your independent living?
Professor Gomez, we are looking forward to how your career will continue to expand. Any last words of wisdom?
Yeah, I find tremendous resource in a broad range of thought leaders and inspirers. I certainly don't have any hold or magic over what is inclusive design or universal design or life-centered design. I'm constantly looking for inspiration, for references, to sources, to partnerships. I'm always encouraged about really trying to explore how we evolve from universal design to inclusive design to life-centered design. I'm really obsessed with the lifespan, and that's hopefully going to carry me through my lifespan and how I can influence and impact others as we extend the lifespan to future generations. So thank you very much for providing me the opportunity to share some of my 33 plus years. I look forward to hearing some of your stories or sharing in some of your ideas or ideologies, and please feel free to reach out and share with me. You're most welcome to join our Wednesday seminars. We have people coming in all the time across the country and beyond, whether you're coming in from Brazil or from Beijing or wherever you may be. So thank you very much and look forward to interacting or engaging with you at another occasion.
Thank you, Professor Gomez, for sharing insights from 30 plus years of long advocacy and practice in inclusive and life-centered design during this wonderful deep dive. I do feel that we can all take away that this is something we can also practice in our own lives. We all can become designers. We are all experts in our own lives. So I hope this was inspiring. Thank you all for being here.
Before you leave, you want to tell them how you and I met and where we met?
We met at a Universal Design Conference in Tokyo about 10 years ago. I was invited by the Institute for Human-Centered Design in Boston, and Professor Gomez is on the board, even though we both live in the Bay Area.
Imagine, I had to go all the way to Tokyo to meet someone that was across the Bay. And we've been in touch since then, so it's wonderful.
Yes, thank you again.
Thank you for allowing me to be part of your podcast. This is a pleasure.
This episode of At Home On Air was produced by the At Home with Growing Older team. We could not host these conversations without the generosity of our marvelous and passionate guests and hosts. Thank you for sharing your personal and professional insights. Thank you to our live audience for your thoughtful contributions. To subscribe to this podcast and for more information, visit us at homewithgrowingolder.org. Thank you to our sponsor, the Walnut Foundation, a San Francisco family foundation. At Home with Growing Older strives to educate, inspire, and connect people across generations and disciplines to re-envision and improve the experiences of later life. Don't forget to subscribe and tune in for the next episode.